You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including the history of the Northwest Forest Plan, budget cuts at Cal Poly Humboldt, and police response to mental health crises. I'm Jane Vaughn, housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
And I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
Our colleague Roman Battaglia is off today, but we'll start with this conversation I recorded with him yesterday. Hey, Roman.
Hey there, Jane.
So you published a story today delving into the history of the Northwest Forest Plan. For those of us who don't know, because I've been seeing you do research on this for a while and I still don't really have any idea what this is, what is the Northwest Forest Plan?
I will try to explain it so that you understand. So it's this giant plan that basically covers how federal forests are managed across western Washington, western Oregon, and then a part of northern California. And it does a lot of different stuff, but a big part is it designates different parts of the forest for different purposes. So like for old growth forest protection, for logging, for scientific purposes. Then it also outlines kind of guidelines for how to manage, you know, those different allocations. So this plan was a really big deal back at the time. It was enacted in 1994, and it was meant to solve a big debate over forest management. Since 1991, you know, logging was essentially banned throughout the Northwest because of this threatened bird called the northern spotted owl, which you've probably heard of before, right?
I have.
So this owl thrives in old growth forest, which is inconveniently the same place people like to log because that's where the big, nice trees are. And so this court injunction in 91 blocked logging in forests within the range of the owl because the government essentially didn't have a good enough plan to protect the owl from logging. And then Congress had, you know, thus far failed to do anything about it. So Bill Clinton, who was elected president in 1992, promised to fix this problem. So he brought together a bunch of scientists to come up with a way to balance protecting the old growth forests and logging timber, which is what they eventually did. And that's what the Northwest Forest Plan is.
Okay, interesting. So it was enacted back in 1994, you said. So why did you decide to do a story on the history of this plan right now?
Yeah, it's a bit late. But, mainly it's because the government's actually amending the plan right now, or at least they're looking at it. This is the first time the plan's been re-looked at since it was adopted. I didn't know a lot about the plan at the time. This was last year, and I wanted to learn more about that. So I ended up going to the library, and I got a couple books about the plan, including one that was recently published by some of the scientists behind the plan. And then that gave me the idea to kind of do a deep dive into the history of the plan, because I think, you know, a lot of people, maybe like yourself, don't know a lot about what went into the plan. So I talked with a bunch of these scientists that worked on the plan while they kind of worked on different options that the president would eventually pick that would become the plan.
Okay, cool. So what kind of impact has this Northwest Forest Plan had on Northwest forests these past 31 years?
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated. On one hand, it's done a lot. On one hand, it hasn't done a lot. It's solved this deadlock that allowed logging to continue, but it also hasn't really done much to protect a northern spotted owl, which is really what it was for. While northern spotted owl habitat has increased slightly in the first 25 years of the plan, spotted owl populations have declined 61%, which is a lot. And a lot of that is because of this invasive barred owl that outcompetes the northern spotted owl for territory. And, you know, the percentage of old growth forest has essentially remained the same, which, I mean, to some people could be a good thing because that means old growth forests were protected. One of the scientists also told me that a big positive to this plan is that it shifted the emphasis from logging to ecosystems protection. But a lot of the hopes that scientists have had for the plan haven't really panned out. I talked to, you know, one of them in the story on our website about these so-called adaptive management areas, where scientific research was the goal. They were trying to, you know, maybe conduct experiments there to figure out how they could best protect, you know, species and stuff. But environmental folks got worried that it was just going to be used to find more ways to log trees. And so, you know, those areas haven't been really used as intended. I think a lot of them have ended up just being managed for logging instead of being, you know, used as research areas.
Okay, so some of it panned out, some of it hasn't really panned out. What did you learn talking to scientists about the plan and its successes over the years?
Yeah, I think one thing that was interesting that I didn't include was attitudes about logging and how they've shifted over the years. So in 1986, 70% of Oregonians supported logging old growth forests. But then by 2001, 75% of Oregon and Washington residents wanted to protect old growths. So that kind of really shows, you know, how much this whole crisis and the environmental movement grew over that time, which was, you know, interesting to me. And another interesting thing I didn't have time to cover was how these scientists were really isolated from outside influence. This was a really big moment for scientists because the president here was, you know, approaching things science first. He wanted scientists to be working on this problem and approaching it from an objective point of view. And so the scientists themselves deliberately kept out people like BLM and Forest Service supervisors and managers. Part of that was because, you know, there were a lot of government scientists involved in the plan, and they wanted them to speak their mind freely. And at the time, a lot of people high up in the BLM and the Forest Service were very pro-logging. So, you know, they didn't want to have their influence there. And so one thing that was interesting in the book I was reading when I talked to them is if supervisors showed up to the office while they were working on this plan, they had to wear orange hunting vests to identify themselves. And then their presence would be announced to everyone there. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they said that by the time they told supervisors they'd have to do that, it was usually enough to just get them to leave and mm-hmm. not be there. And that allowed the scientists to focus on just the science without any of that outside pressure. You know, the scientists I talked to said they didn't feel like they had any pressure to increase logging, which was really good. And I think that was a pretty important part of the plan in the end.
Okay, cool. Really interesting. Thank you, Roman.
Yeah, thanks.
Jane, turning to you, you wrote a story this week about budget cuts at Cal Poly Humboldt in Arcata. First, why is the university having financial challenges?
So there's a couple of reasons that the university has pointed to. One of them is not enough students are enrolling, and one of them is less state funding. So the California governor, Gavin Newsom, has come out with his proposed budget, I think came out in January, so not final yet. But that budget says that schools in the California State University system, like Cal Poly Humboldt, should plan for an almost 8% reduction in state funding next fiscal year. So the university will get obviously less money. And then that proposed budget is also deferring money for the California State University system for 2 years. So they wouldn't get that until 2027, 2028. And that's $250 million for the system. So that's also less money for Cal Poly Humboldt. And then in particular, they are also having trouble enrolling students, it seems, and they have a university system, the California State University system enrollment target. And Cal Poly Humboldt is about 26% below that target. And so they're going to also lose some funding from that because they're not enrolling as many students as they would like to or should. And so all of that adds up to what they're expecting to have is an over $27 million deficit in the next 3 years.
Wow, so that's a pretty big deficit,
yeah.
And that university isn't huge. Right. So what programs are going to be cut?
We don't know yet. It hasn't been determined. We're still obviously early in the budget process, and each of the school's divisions is planning for some budget cuts. So the University Resources and Planning Committee has been meeting with the various departments and discussing what they might have to trim. They've been asked to make plans for 5%, 7%, and 9% cuts, and they have done presentations on what might we cut and what would that look like in our department if we had to cut 5, 7, or 9%. Many departments have already been working on eliminating programs or consolidating programs. They didn't say which programs, but that is sort of in the works. They did say in the Academic Affairs Department it might mean eliminating certain concentrations or increasing the class sizes or reducing course offerings. So there are some tangible things that might happen there. But like I said, the final budget hasn't been decided yet. The University Resources and Planning Committee has heard all of these presentations, and then they're going to make recommendations for budget cuts later on.
Right. So no final budget yet, but the university has some ideas. What else is the college going to try to do to address this financial situation?
So for now, for this upcoming fiscal year, they're anticipating a budget deficit of over $13.5 million. And so their plan in the short term is they're going to use up to $4 million in one-time funds. And then they're also going to try to reduce their operating budget by about $9.5 million, which hopefully will fill that $13.5 million hole. Reducing the operating budget obviously will be some sort of budget cuts and these things that we've been talking about to be determined what exactly those will be. They've also started a temporary, what they're calling a hiring chill for state-funded positions. So that means that any hiring requests have to be approved by the executive leadership. So hopefully they're only hiring for people that are really, really needed, trying to save some money in that way. There was also a letter from the university leadership saying that they're exploring potentially restricting non-essential costs, deferring certain projects, seeking alternative funding sources, restructuring departments, reducing service levels, and making programmatic changes. So they have a whole list of things they're looking at that's pretty broad, and they haven't been really specific yet on what exactly they're going to cut. But the budget will be finalized this summer, and so we'll have to wait and see what they decide, where they decide to make those cuts.
Yeah, thanks, Jane.
And Justin, I'm going to turn it back to you. You reported on changes in policy this week for Del Norte County Police who are responding to mental health emergencies. So what's changing there and why?
So I spoke to the Del Norte County Sheriff this week who said his officers can't risk responding to some mental health crisis calls, like suicide, for example, anymore due to potential liability issues. And this comes from a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision that came down over the summer. That case was about a 2019 incident when where a Las Vegas man called the police. He was having paranoid delusions of people trying to break into his apartment. It was some sort of mental health episode. And then when the police arrived, they restrained him on the ground. He lost consciousness, and he later died in the hospital. And those officers were sued. So police generally have something called qualified immunity, which protects them if something goes wrong, like this, if they're responding to a crime and there's an accident, as long as they're kind of doing everything else right and by the book. But the judge in this Ninth Circuit case ruled that these police in Las Vegas actually don't have that qualified immunity because they weren't responding to a crime. They were responding to a medical situation. So those officers can be found liable for that death. And so in Del Norte County, the sheriff said his officers, you know, they'll still respond to a scene. If there's any threat to the public safety, they can set up a perimeter, for example, if a firearm is involved. But if there's no crime, they won't be first responders. And notably, suicide is not illegal in California. So if someone's alone in their house with a gun, they can't, they won't any longer show up and be first responders in that case.
Okay. So who's going to respond then when there are mental health emergencies in the county?
That'll likely be left to other first responders like fire and ambulance personnel, medical staff. Del Norte launched a new mobile unit for mental health and substance use emergencies last month. You actually did the story on that. And that'll help. But the sheriff said that rural areas like his really need more resources for mental health, especially now that police can have just limited contact. He says they often have to wait for over a week, actually, to get someone having a mental health emergency or some sort of episode into a state facility. There's no facilities in the county there, and they can't hold them in jail if they haven't broken the law. So they need to be held at a local hospital until a bed opens up.
Right. That's really interesting. So are there any other departments that are considering a change in policy then?
I couldn't find other departments in our area that have recently changed their policy, although I spoke with the Tehama County Sheriff yesterday after the story ran, unfortunately. And he said they have a similar policy, actually, to Del Norte, but it was in place before that court decision. So even without that decision, they thought it was too risky to respond to cases like this. Last month, the Sacramento County Sheriff announced his department would also no longer respond to mental health calls when a crime isn't suspected. And it's important to remember the Ninth Circuit covers seven western states, including Oregon and California. No departments in Oregon got back to me about changes in their policy, but this court decision could impact departments really across the West.
Okay, great. And then I want to make sure we have time for the other story you did this week about Rogue Valley residents snapping up backyard chickens. Why are people buying chickens?
Yeah, really quickly, just the price of eggs. Everyone's noticed that. It's because of the bird flu and the culling of millions and millions of chickens and ducks, which has led to a drop in supply and an increase in the price of eggs. And so I'm sure a lot of listeners have had the same thought. I'll just buy my own chickens, control the means of production. And that's what people are doing in the Rogue Valley. I went to a Grants Pass store who they were giving away five free chicks with purchase of a bag of chicken feed. And they ran out of 300 chicks within like 30 minutes of opening.
Wow.
So people are really rushing to buy their own chickens.
That's great. And really quick, you reported that backyard chickens can still catch bird flu, though.
Yeah, that's an important point to note. They can catch it from wild birds. So the Oregon Department of Agriculture recommends chicken owners take precautions like having a good enclosure and making sure you wash your hands or change mm-hmm. your clothes if you're touching any other, you know, wild animal life before you touch your own chickens.
Okay, great. Thanks, Justin. That's it for the debrief this week. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. That's on our website at ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more at jeffexchange.org or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and all the other platforms.